Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today is a translator and an author, and she has brought a book about a very particular era in mountaineering, which I think is really fascinating. And she's brought this into the English language so that we can all share this, which I think is a great thing. And the book is called Peaks and Bandits, and I'm going to try very hard here to get this right. It's by Alf Bonnevie Bryn, who was a Norwegian mountaineer climbing in this book around about 1909. And I think he gives a fascinating insight into what was really a golden era at that time. So I'd like to introduce Bibby Lee. Hello, Bibby. How are you?
Hello. How are you? I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. Okay. But perhaps before we start the sort of discussion, would you like to read a section from the book that you translated?
I will be happy to.
Okay. Off you go.
Off I go. Okay. This is a chapter from their climb all around the mountains of Corsica. It is the next to last chapter, which is called Cinque Frati and Paglia Orba. We found our little campsite in perfect order. We lit a huge fire, bathed in the creek, ate, sunbathed, and made plans that day and the next. George thought we had to stick to being an alpine expedition, not an archaeological one. And as an alpine expedition, it was our task to make ascents, preferably new ones, which were as difficult as possible. George was undeniably right. Right above our campsite, we had, as mentioned, Paglia Orba, an impressive looking mountain from the position we were viewing it from, but one that is easy and simple to climb from the other side. A mountaineer does not get discouraged because the peak he wants to climb is easy to ascend from one side. Right away, he finds another side, and it turns out that on almost any peak, a mountaineer can bring himself into considerable difficulty and danger. We knew this would be so in the case of Paglia Orba, when we attacked it from the south, the side facing our tent. The upper 1,500 to 1,800 feet look to be practically vertical. From down below, it is often difficult to judge where to take the path up a mountainside, and we therefore decided to prepare the ascent of Paglia Orba by first climbing the peaks of Cinque Frati on the other side of the valley, from where we could study the south wall of Paglia Orba through binoculars and then make our plan for the trip. We decided to start with the southernmost peak and then follow the ridge as far as possible until we came to the northernmost and highest one. To humor Max, our youngest member, George and I arranged that he should assume leadership of this expedition in return for carrying our entire luggage. That's how Max ended up with such a heavy backpack. George and I figured that with such good weather and Max carrying everything, we could carry and bring ample provisions along to the top. From this, we gleaned few pleasures. It is common practice in mountain climbing to divide the dangers you encounter into subjective and objective categories. Subjective dangers are those dangers you can think upon, and objective ones are those that nature and other people may expose you to, and about which there is nothing you can do one way or another. Max went first during our climb up through a fairly steep fissure toward the top of the southernmost Frati, according to plan. George and I just let him go the whole length of the rope, partly because we had found a clever place to stand and smoke cigarettes. Once in a while, we glanced up at a 60 or 70 degree angle and saw Max's backside, boot soles, and part of his bird bag. standing on a little shelf in a mountain wall, tied by rope to a man you can only see by his boot soles and the seat of his pants, can be quite nerve-wracking. It is best not to have a lively imagination if you spend your time painting pictures of how things would go if he lost his grip. You don't get anything near the 100% benefit of the cigarette. Our imaginations meant that neither George nor I did. We didn't exactly imagine we would get Max down on our heads, but little rocks now and then made our stay at the bottom of the fissure less peaceful than we would have wished. Our eyes followed Max with considerable self-interest, and then things began to unravel. Literally. Somehow the string that closed his bird bag must have become caught in a crack. In any case, when Max was about 120 to 150 feet above us, the bag opened and started to pour our precious provisions all over us. We managed to catch the half loaf of bread that came first, but after it, a big jar of orange marmalade came sailing down. It is quite unpleasant to be standing at the bottom of a fissure while a jar of marmalade comes whistling down toward you. Even though you have filled your hat with crumpled up paper, something you ought always to do if you have a novice climber above you on a mountain, this helps very little against a 1-quart ceramic jar full of cross and blackwell marmalade. Against such things, you ought to be equipped with the now popular steel helmet, but these were not on the market back then. And anyway, you cannot walk around in a steel helmet for weeks just because of such a remote possibility. About 5 feet above the little shelf where George and I were standing, the marmalade jar splashed against the protruding rock where it lost a major part of its force and distributed its contents almost evenly over George and me. After a while, Max also became aware that all was not as should be and tried, in spite of being somewhat constrained, to get hold of the opening in his bird bag. But he was also burdened by an ice axe that in some unfathomable manner was fastened to the back of his pack. And his effort to get hold of the bird bag string immediately resulted in the ice axe following the marmalade jar. All this was very stressful for George and me, as we could not get away from the fissure we were in without jerking the rope, which was now stretched almost all the way out and getting all of Max and the rest of the equipment all over us. We undeservedly escaped the attack of the ice axe when it somehow got caught just below Max. Considering the situation, we found it politically unwise to enter into a discussion with Max about what had happened, and we calmly continued after him up to the top, decorated in orange marmalade. Once in the safety of the top of the southernmost of Cinque Frati, we explained to him in a straightforward manner that could not be misunderstood that we thought of what we thought about his undoubtedly deliberate, cowardly attacks on his elders. That is it.
That's funny because you chose one of the passages that actually stood out for me in the book. Because it's very funny, isn't it? I love the way he writes them being pelted with marmalade. You know, that's a brilliant brilliant comic scene, and yet I'm sure that's exactly what happened. I don't think he exaggerated that one bit. We should say no. When he was he's writing about where are most of these climbs actually set then that he writes about?
Well, they are in the north central part of the island.
Of Corsica, isn't it?
Corsica, yes, which I was very happy to be in when I translated this book some nine, 10 years ago, actually.
Oh, really? You're actually in. I've been to. It's a lovely place, Corsica.
Yes, it is very nice.
It's got very
Very nice
rugged,
indeed.
very rugged mountains, so it's great for the mountaineer. But it's also you're never actually that far from a beach either. So you can sort of alternate between climbing and then lying on a beach for a while. It's a great place from that point of
Yes.
view.
But
And
what comes through in the book is also that in 1909, which is when this story takes place, there was a lot of snow in Corsica. So they were battling ice and snow in all their climbs, which is interesting because there is no snow there now.
Oh, of
So,
course, yes. But with global
yes.
warming, I suppose, yeah. And it's
Yes,
also the
absolutely.
case that, in a way, they were climbing in what was mountaineering's golden age, because Corsica at that time, many of the peaks had hardly been explored. Is that right?
That's correct, if I understood the book right. I don't think many people went there to climb mountains.
Hmm.
It was a novel adventure.
And a lot of the places that they came to, what he also paints, I think, really well, is a picture of a lot of the remote villages that they arrived in, that actually weren't really used to seeing outsiders at all. Is that the impression that you got?
That is definitely the impression I get. Yes.
And did you act, so did you actually I suppose it's not did you actually visit some of the scenes of the crimes then? Did you actually go to some of the places that he described?
Yes. In fact, I stayed in Kalakucha, called Kalakuch for short, in a wonderful hotel, and had a good time there.
Oh, right. That's amazing. There was also a fair amount of violence in the book, I have to say.
Yes, I don't think they were short on violence or on fear of violence.
No. I mean, certainly they. Well, we'll talk on talk about George's his companion in a minute, but I think their idea when they thought they were being threatened was to hit somebody first. I think
Yes, yes.
that was
George
which
was George
which.
was apparently very good at that. Yes.
It sounds like it. It sounds like he was extremely good at that. It
Yes.
did occur to me that some of the people might have been completely innocent at the time, and they
Yes.
were suddenly set upon by these two. At one point, he flattened the bloke they had a paraffin lamp, I think, which he clobbered him over the head with, which I thought was so that's
Just
certainly.
to be on the safe side. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that
Yeah.
certainly made sure that he wasn't going to do anything, didn't it? That
Yes.
was very good. Yeah. Now, the
Yes.
George. What's interesting is the George he's talking about is George Finch, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Now, George Finch was well. He went on to be, one of the foremost alpinists of his day. And also to play, I think, quite an important role in the 1922 expedition to Everest. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that is right. Yes.
And go on.
Interesting to me to meet George Finch in 1909 with a Norwegian friend and mountain climber. They were both students in Switzerland at the time. So it's
Oh, right.
an interesting background element in George Finch's life. And there is a biography out on him by a Mr. Wainwright, as you probably know.
I didn't, to be honest.
A good book.
Never underestimate my ignorance. Okay, that's fair
Okay, nor mine.
enough. But no, quite a fascinating. Very, both of them very, very strong characters, obviously. And I
Yes.
thought one of the interesting. How can I put it? They weren't above. How can I obtaining things slightly dishonestly if that was required? Is that also
Sneakily. They were
sneakily?
sneakily, yes.
I'm not sure I read the. I didn't actually read the whole book, but at one point they found this village, and am I right? They stole a goat carving. Is that do you remember that section?
Yes, they stole a carving of a mouflon, and the mouflon is a mountain sheep that is wild, and you still see them in Corsica. In fact, we did see them. Yeah.
Right, and
they stole this. They stole this carving, took it with them, and Brun, in his account, says that George actually gave this to the British Museum at a later date.
Right, I missed that bit. But one of the funny things that he talks about was that they had they'd abseiled down into this village down some rock face, and they stole this carved goat, which was obviously a very significant artifact from the village. And then when they went to go back and climb the ladder and climb up the rope they'd abseiled down, someone had taken that, so they couldn't get up. They had to sneak past the ladder.
Get back up. Yes, they had a very difficult time getting away from there. But yeah. They did.
They said, yeah. That's right. And at one point, I think it was after the marmalade incident, he related the they had some roast beef, I think, something like that. Which
oh dear,
do you remember that that section? Yeah. It sounded awful because what happened was it went off, and they decided we're not going to eat this, so they threw it away down a crevasse, and then of course they ran out of food. And then they thought, well, the only thing they had was the roast beef they'd thrown away. So they then went and rescued the roast beef and somehow managed to eat it.
And it tasted deliciously, yes.
Yeah. It reminded me a bit of P.G. Wodehouse's writing.
Oh, really?
Well, P.G. Wodehouse writes of it's a very unspecified time, somewhere round about the beginning of the 20th century, somewhere, he never actually says when it is, I remember one passage from the book where Brin says they look really scruffy, these two climbers, obviously, because they had dirty clothes, but nobody seemed to mind in the south of Italy. And he said, of course, if you were to walk down Piccadilly with the wrong button of your waistcoat fastened up, there'd be a riot. And now that seems to me to come directly from a P.G. Wodehouse sort of point of view.
Well, that's a nice connection to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, and also, of course, because like the Wodehouse sort of novels, which obviously has a sort of relationship between Bertie Wooster and Jeeves, and they're often facing adversity and doing various things. In some ways, that's similar to the sort of relationship between Brin and George Finch. You know, they're two very different people trying to get along in difficult situations. You think there's some truth in that?
Yes. I think that's the basis for the sense of humor that I always found so endearing in this book.
Yeah. And it starts, I think it starts out really well, because it starts out, I don't think it's actually in Corsica, it might be in France, but it starts out with them dangling either side of a ridge, having a portion of the ridge fall off between them. And there's him and his partner, and I think there's three of them, but there's a guy in the middle. And when one bloke fell off the other side of the ridge, he dived off the opposite side and balanced him out.
Correct. And hanging upside down.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they sort of classed that as fun.
They did.
What were the particular challenges when you were translating it? Did you find it a difficult book to translate?
No, I didn't find the entirety of it difficult, but I did have to do some research about mountain climbing language, mm-hmm. vocabulary, which was new to me. And I found some old mountain climbing books in a used bookstore in Menlo Park, California, and it helped me enormously. So that was the one difficulty I had with this.
I can imagine that. Yeah. I think you've actually done a very good job there, to be honest, because it's What struck me about it also was that although he's written it, and I'm sure you've translated it as well, in a way that a non-climber can very easily read it and understand what's happening. But, and this is always a very difficult thing about mountaineering writing, and he's also translated it so that a mountaineer can read it and not feel overly burdened with the explanation. I think you've done a good job of that.
Thank you very much.
It's not an easy thing to do. I know that. Because I often fall and foul.
I bet you do.
Myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not myself a mountain climber, but a Norwegian friend of mine introduced me to this book, and she is a mountain climber. So I was introduced that way to this book, but I was also introduced to serious mountain climbing in the 50s through my father, who loved the book by Sir Edmund Hillary on Everest. Of course, it's a classic in the field.
Yeah. So that was your background.
A little bit. I am a hiker, but I'm not a mountain climber.
No, very, very wise, actually.
Yes, I think so. I understand most mountain climbers are dead, yes.
If it's anything like the mountain climbing that those two, the George and Bryn, George Finch and Bryn took part in, I think it's pretty well avoided. It was fascinating that they, how can I put it, they were almost, they were very much explorers rather than just climbers.
Because I think that is true. Yes, they were explorers. Yes,
because I wouldn't say they were going to exactly to lost worlds, but they were certainly going to places that just didn't see visitors at all. And
no,
of course, there
that's
were.
True.
And they were not sure whether they were going to sort of, you know, meet with hostile responses or whether they'd be able to communicate with people, because I don't think they had. They struggled with the language all the time, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And they must have looked fairly peculiar to the local population, I must say, in their hobnails and knickers. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure they did. I'm sure. Well, of
I'm
course,
sure they did.
I'm guessing most of the people in the villages, you know, wouldn't have seen anybody. The idea of climbing mountains would have been pretty bizarre.
Would have been alien, yes.
Yeah.
And then ice axe, you know, I think the locals must have seen it as a weapon.
So because they would have had fairly long sort of what they used to call Aschenbrenners in those days,
yes,
which would have been certainly right. a pretty lethal weapon, and yes. They had great hobnail boots and
yes,
you probably could have heard them coming on stone.
I should imagine.
But quite yeah. some distance, I would have thought.
Yes. Yeah.
But I found it fascinating because it's a book about mountain climbing, but it really does capture that spirit and that age where two young men, as they were, could set off going particularly, basically a lot of the time, not actually knowing where they were going and have an adventure in somewhere and scrapes and falling out with the local police and all that sort of stuff. They came out of it all right, really, didn't they, at the end?
Yes, they did. Yes, it is an adventure story. It's a boy's own adventure.
That's exactly yeah. what it is, a boy's own adventure. Yeah,
yes.
that's where, and I think that probably it captures an age, you know, obviously the First World War was only a handful of years away. And I can't imagine that the world that they painted would really have survived that. It, you know, I think it would have changed everybody. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
I mean, go on, sorry. It was in some ways an age of innocence, I think.
Seems that way, yeah.
And yeah. both of them survived the war, didn't they? Is that right?
They did. They did. And Bryn went on to become a patent engineer He had an office in on the main street in Oslo. And he wrote this book in 1937, I believe. And it was published in 43, which was an unfortunate year to be published.
Yeah, not a bad one.
Yeah, so I think it didn't go very far when it was first published, but became a collector's item later on. And then a Norwegian publisher republished it in 2010. So that's
as recently as that.
English translation. Yeah, we also have it in French translation. So
right.
It has good history lately.
And so is it quite a significant book in for Norwegian mountaineers? That's not something I know much about, but is it
it would be a good piece of a slice of history, you know?
Yeah. So
in that sense, I think it has been important to those who climb mountains. Yes,
I think so. Yeah. Well, there can't have been many Norwegian mountaineers in Corsica at that time. I wouldn't have thought.
I don't think so.
So it's a fascinating book. I think I'm really pleased that you've managed to translate it and brought it into a completely new audience, and I guess a worldwide audience in some ways, which is really.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think it deserves to be there. How can I put it? It's a very idiosyncratic little book, and I think it's all the better for that.
Thank you.
You think so?
Yes.
Okay. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'll put links to the book on my website and on the podcast page. And thanks very much for all your work. And I'm really grateful for you bringing this lovely little book into the sort of mountaineering parlance. So Bibi Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.